It's done. It's signed.
I consider this very much a bill for the middle class and a bill for jobs. And jobs are produced through companies and corporations. And you see that happening. Corporations are literally going wild over this. I think even beyond my expectations.
It's time for voters to see what they think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, December 22nd. Good to have you with us. And while the president and Congress may have gotten out of town, we are still here to start the show with a conversation about the economic week that was and what lies ahead. Joining me live are Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine and Anna Swanson of The New York Times. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
All right, so let's start with the president's quote there that we played in the open. Lee, are companies going wild over this? You know, the big knock of this tax bill was that they would just fatten dividends. Is there evidence that they are giving back here?
Well, sure. In the first 24 hours, we've seen it rain money on American workers. I mean, I'm you know, we saw a number of companies come right out and say that they were giving bonuses. And AT&T said it's investing $1 billion in the U.S. next year. That's significant money. And some other companies are actually not just doing the bonus thing. They're actually raising wages. So you can't, you know, knock that one bit. But on the other hand, it's hard not to look at its PR. This is also a pipeline kind of straight to the president's heart and his ego and proving that he's right. So it just remains to be seen.
You know, Anna, you had this lovely piece today about steelworkers who felt that they got a promise from President Trump during the campaign and now feel betrayed because the steel industry is not doing that well. Does this tax cut restore any faith for them, do you think?
I think it does restore a little bit. But for them, you know, trade was the president's signature campaign promise that they were looking to. And the president did actually win a lot of votes who formerly would have gone to the left because of the promises he made on trade with workers who liked his populism. And I think it points out that, you know, with taxes, some of his major legislative accomplishments have now come through. But there are a lot of things that we're still waiting to see. And a lot of the trade orders that he executive orders that he had on trade just sort of ordered investigations rather than leading to actual outcomes. So it's creating a lot of uncertainty for companies and these workers.
You know, speaking of uncertainty, it will be a year plus until actual real life people feel this thing, maybe not in their paychecks if they are getting these bonuses, but in terms of tax policy. I'd like both of you to weigh in. Lee, you can go first. Does a year and a half matter in political time? That's an awfully long gap.
It's a really long time. But, you know, I think we will see an immediate impact. We already have in the stock market, and people, that is puts a real fixed imprint in people's minds, and it lasts. And so depending on what the market does next year, I think that could impact things. But everything else, you're right. It's going to take a long time for these things to work their way through the system.
Anna, what do you think in terms of, you know, the people you were out talking to, how much do their 2018 taxes that they will file in 2019, you know, is there a connection with that yet, or is that so far away that it's almost irrelevant?
I think you're right. I mean, taxpayers won't really see the effects of this until they file their taxes in 2019. But it does give the president and Republicans a major legislative accomplishment heading into midterms. And whatever you think of the bill, obviously that's a positive for them. Unfortunately, polling shows that this tax bill is strikingly unpopular for a major tax bill. And even some tax hikes in history have pulled better than this tax cut, which shows just how polarized and suspicious voters are. So we'll have to see if Republicans can change that message in the months to come.
And we're all also spending time digesting it. After all, a giant piece of legislation, you know, as many members said who voted on this thing, that they didn't know what was in it.
They didn't know what was in it. I mean, we all have whiplash just from the news. This was pushed through incredibly fast. And you can only imagine if we are having trouble digesting it. Imagine the position the IRS is in. I mean, the IRS, whose budget has been cut since 2010. Last time we passed a major tax overhaul, the IRS was Congress gave the IRS a lot more money. So it's not just us who are going to be, you know, digesting, as you say.
Sticking with this sort of Washington theme for a little bit, you know, there was a continuing resolution passed to keep funding the government, but there is a lot still kind of on the plate in terms of major policy fights, not politics as much, when Congress comes back and when everybody returns from their holidays.
Is there an area where either of you think we're going to see real movement? After all, there have been sort of some punts on things like funding for CHIP. The immigration battle has sort of gone away for the moment in terms of money. So what's left to talk about in January?
Well, there are a couple of things on the table. Oh, go ahead, Anna. Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. They're going to be talking about military funding and disaster relief. And with the continuing resolution they passed, they have delayed by a few weeks a major fight that seems to be brewing over DACA, the program for immigrants brought to the United States as children. But I think the big looming showdown is over entitlements. So the tax bill is adding a lot to the deficit. And the fact is that many Republicans who advocated the tax cuts also think the government spends far too much money. So it remains to be seen they'll meet opposition on that from the president, who's called for preserving things like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
And I think that one thing we've seen is that now that the tax bill has passed, the divisiveness is just going to be all the more concentrated on both sides.
Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine, Anna Swanson of the New York Times, thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
On Wall Street today, a little slip on a light trading day, plus, whoa, Bitcoin. Details when we do the numbers. This next story is for all the people who waited to the last minute to do their Christmas shopping. It is too late to order stuff online and get it by the holiday, so you got to go to the mall. Brick and mortar stores have actually got the advantage right now, and they may not be offering the best last minute deals. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
Jeffrey Dutton knows more and more people are doing their holiday shopping online at home.
In their pajamas or taking a bubble bath, blissfully shopping online.
But not Dutton. Instead, he's standing in front of Macy's in downtown Washington on a chilly December afternoon.
So I thought I would go into Macy's to check and see if there were any discounts right before the holidays.
But he may be out of luck. The stuff he could have gotten online from the bathtub, a lot of it's gone. Stores aren't rewarding last-minute shoppers like they used to. They're trying not to overstock, so they're left with less stuff they have to offload right before Christmas.
This is one of the areas in retail that is more of an art than a science.
Steve Osborne is with Kurt Salmon.
With big data, I think retailers are getting much better at predicting what the buying patterns will be throughout the Christmas season.
So there's less stuff to choose from, and it's more picked over, because more people did their holiday shopping early this year. Chris Christopher with IHS Market says already this holiday shopping season is on track to be the best since 2014. And it's not your imagination. Christopher says holiday sales are starting earlier than ever, a couple days after Halloween.
You get the sugar rush after all that candy you eat, and then you can head out and get some good deals.
Back at Macy's, Angela Odom of Bowie, Maryland is returning something she bought online. She does prefer online shopping, but at sites that have a store she can go to.
So a lot of places that I buy from have a bricks and mortar place nearby, so I can take it back.
That plays into another retail strategy this year. Stores like you to buy something online, then come in to pick it up at a desk way in the back. So you can do more shopping in the store on your way to pick up that online order. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now to corporate news and Google's parent company, Alphabet. Eric Schmidt, who's stepping down as Alphabet's executive chairman, helped transform the once promising startup into the internet giant it is today. He spent 17 years there, oversaw a massive corporate restructuring when Google created Alphabet. And yeah, while we know the company's core business is strong, we wondered, how's the rest of it doing? Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
Google's search engine is still one of the first things people think of when they think about the company. And that makes sense, says RBC internet analyst Mark Mahaney.
The Google search engine would probably account for over 80% of the company's total profits.
But that's just one unit of Alphabet. There are other riskier parts of the business known as, quote unquote, other bets.
You know, it's a little bit of a play off the word alphabet.
Ah, other bets, alphabet, clever.
It's kind of their R&D lab, and they've essentially made it public.
Mahaney says some of the other bets include Nest, which is a maker of smart thermostats. There's Verily, which is research dedicated to preventing disease. And my favorite, Calico, a project dedicated to prolonging the human lifespan.
Unfortunately for all of us, there's no evidence yet there's anything that's going to come out of that, but we're all hoping.
In fact, there's no evidence that something will come out of many of the projects. Max Wolf is a chief economist at the Phoenix Group.
These are really expensive vanity projects. They're exciting. They probably advance science, but they don't seem to advance the bottom line or the margin.
The other bets have generated some revenue, but overall, RBC's Mahaney says they've cost the company more than $10 billion over the past few years. Brent Thill, an internet analyst with Jefferies, says one of the most promising bets is Waymo, a self-driving car project.
This could effectively be, in our belief, a $125 billion valued business embedded inside of Google.
The challenge, he says, will be for Alphabet to get ahead of its competitors, to turn experiments into businesses before its rivals do. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Marketplace. We've talked about the exodus underway from Puerto Rico to Florida and how Hurricane Maria helped put it into fast forward. Since the storm, nearly 200,000 people have fled the island, but that doesn't mean they've cut ties, either economic or emotional. As Marketplace's Renata Sago reports, a rapidly growing Puerto Rican population in Orlando wants and needs to stay in touch with island life.
Jose Hernandez's room at an Orlando hotel is small. It's paid for by FEMA. He, his mom, and two younger sisters make it work. They have two beds and a blow-up mattress. Everyone gets one dresser drawer. They even have a small plastic Christmas tree with a Puerto Rican flag next to it. The setup is missing a lot of comforts, but it does have one important necessity: free wireless internet. They use it to call family back home with WhatsApp. It's their only way to connect.
I don't know if they have any signal right now. I will try to call them and see.
Hernandez checks in with his grandmother, aunts, and cousins. They own a car repair business and property back on the island and have vowed to stay. Their Wi-Fi on the island is still spotty, and they have to rely on generators to charge their phones.
Hola.
Mira, llegó la luz. She doesn't have too much signal right now. That's why she doesn't hear me.
Coming to the mainland was never a plan for Hernandez. But the 22-year-old lost his job at a restaurant on the island. He couldn't go to school because the university closed, and his mother couldn't return to the hospital where she worked because it collapsed. A friend gifted plane tickets, and they left. Hernandez's young sisters are now enrolled in middle school. They can all stay in the hotel through the middle of January. Hernandez has two jobs, one waiting tables at a tapas place and another selling theme park passes. His mom can't find work as a secretary. She's trying to learn English.
It's been hard. We didn't know about the cost here. It's really, really high. I'm the only one working right now, and that's not good.
Phone calls back to family on the island are like doses of oxygen.
They always say to us that we have to be positive. Never give up. That's what they say to us. And no matter what we decide, they want us to be better and have a very good life.
The Hernandez family is apartment hunting. They plan to settle in Orlando. They're just some of the latest of about 200,000 Puerto Ricans who've left the island after Hurricane Maria for Florida. Historian Luis Martinez Fernandez says past waves of migration from the island have happened in slow motion. Maria is a much more sudden disruption.
During the other waves, well, people could plan to relocate. Maybe they could travel here and see if they can find a job, stay with relatives. What we're looking at now has a sense of urgency.
He says it's because Maria struck an island that had already been suffering from crumbling infrastructure and growing debt. Even as people leave, though, they can maintain more of a connection than in the past.
People can Skype. People can travel for what's not large amounts of money. What we used to see as an almost complete breakup of the family, well, now we have families who are living actually in both places.
Martinez Fernandez estimates another 750,000 people will leave the island in the next 4 to 5 years. That's nearly a quarter of the population. He imagines it'll be mostly property owners who will have to give up on rebuilding.
What do you do if you have $30,000 worth of damage? You have no insurance. It's very hard to rebuild when you don't have the resources to do that.
He expects other migrants will be business owners who can't make a profit with fewer customers around. And if and when those holdouts leave, it'll be easier since they'll have relatives like Jose Hernandez to connect with on the mainland. In Orlando, I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
You can listen to a one-hour Marketplace Weekend special report on Puerto Rico and its recovery from Maria. Just go to our website, marketplace.org. Coming up,
avocado green really was one of the most fashionable colors of the decade.
Yeah, let's hope history doesn't repeat itself. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 28 points, a tenth of a percent, to close at 24,754. The NASDAQ shed 5 points, essentially flat, to finish at 6,959. And the S&P 500 lost a point, pretty much unchanged, to end at 2,683. For the week, the Dow added 0.4%, the NASDAQ gained 0.3%, and the S&P 500 rose 0.2%. We looked into the departure of Eric Schmidt, chairman of Google parent Alphabet, which clicked down 0.1%. Microsoft was unchanged. And after riding high, the Bitcoin thrill ride plunged, losing more than 30% of its value at one point. By the end of the day, the sell-off moderated. Bitcoin fell 8%. Bonds fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note essentially flat, 2.48%. You're listening to Marketplace.
When it comes to news about the economy, Marketplace has got you covered. And when you donate $10 a month or more to support the work we do, you can get a Marketplace umbrella to help protect you from stormy weather. The real benefit of giving comes when you listen every day, knowing that you're making it possible for Marketplace to help people understand the economy and the financial forces that govern our lives. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll be able to do more of it and reach more people as well. Become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. I am hosting the show from our New York bureau today, and while it is all sparkly and decorated here now, that wasn't the case a few days ago, until my colleague Ryan Kailath went out to find the office a Christmas tree, and wound up with today's installment of our series, Holidays, brought to you by...
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
New York can be slushy and gray this time of year, but... walk two blocks in any direction, and you'll find yourself transported into a little pine-scented sidewalk forest. Christmas tree stands appear after Thanksgiving. Sidewalks, street corners, and empty lots. The little forests feel entirely out of place in New York City. But Danny Abbott fits right in.
I was called Mountain Man on train last night. I look like a lumberjack, I guess.
He's got the long overalls, the bushy red beard, and the knit cap. But Abbott's a couple steps down the supply chain from lumberjack. He's a tree man. Every winter, hundreds of them descend on the city. Seasonal workers from across the U.S. and often Canada. Most of the year, Abbott's a stonemason, but...
I kind of work slow in the winter, you know. So I've been doing this. It's about my fourth year.
Money-wise, how's this work out?
This is great. This is like going to the casino with $5 and walks out with 500.
Abbott lives out in Queens, but a lot of traveling tree sellers live temporarily in Winnebagoes, outside their stands. They're open 24 hours a day, running a generator at night and handling every part of the business. Hawking trees, trimming, wrapping, and delivery. And then there's the unforeseen duties.
I had to trace a guy down one time with a tree, tried to steal a tree. A little short guy, couldn't run fast. I just took his feet out from under and left him on the ground. Ooh! Picked up a tree, and I was like, what was you thinking, man?
Here at Soho Trees, Abbott earns an hourly wage for the sales and marketing and loss prevention. But the real money comes from tips on deliveries.
It varies from day to day. Like, you can make $40 one day, and then you can make $200.
While we're hanging out, an elegant woman in a fur coat buys a tree. Abbott carries it 5 blocks to her penthouse apartment and sets it up for her. But when he gets back...
I thought she was going to be a good tipper and stuff, and no.
Not a good tipper?
No tip.
Nevertheless, he loves this job.
The guy I worked for before, he was a scumbag. This guy here is great. He's one of the best bosses I ever had.
My name is Scott Lechner. I'm manager of Soho Trees, street boss.
What does street boss mean?
It means that I'm in charge of the day-to-day operations of the Christmas tree locations that we run, 7 locations in Manhattan.
Lechner's been in this business 36 years, and he says this year, the tree game is tough. The growers he buys from planted fewer trees during the recession, and now there's a shortage, which is driving up costs down the line, from grower to lumberjack to freight driver.
Trees are costing about 225% of what they were a mere 3 years ago.
And Lechner says he's raised prices between 5 or 10% to help cover that. This year, a 6-foot tree might run you $100, even $140. But shoppers are used to paying what they're paying, and they won't pay much more. Lechner says at least recruiting workers hasn't gotten any harder.
We interview over 750 to 800 candidates for about 50 jobs every year. A bunch of adventurers and tree zealots.
Back outside, just one last thing to do.
So my office has slept on Christmas and doesn't have a tree. So how much tree will $40 get me? All right. Thanks, guys. I think the most fun part of this is being the guy walking down a New York City sidewalk carrying a Christmas tree.
How tall would you guess that is?
3.
That's exactly right. You've done this before.
I've done it many times. Have a merry.
You too.
In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Christmas tree thing for a second. There is an economic or business story behind just about everything, even color. Here we are again with another story from our occasional series on the backstories of some well-known colors. Today, all about the color green. Get the tree reference now. It's also about how a little brand rehabilitation can go a long way. Here's Cassia St. Clair, author of The Secret Lives of Color, with more.
Green has a bit of a tricky history. Now we tend to think of it in kind of very positive terms. It's, you know, for most people, it will immediately bring to mind kind of environmental causes and health and the outdoors. However, if you were to be able to go back in time and ask a medieval person on the street, they would be much more suspicious of the colour green. It definitely had sort of slightly negative overtones to it. Part of that is because there aren't many naturally green pigments that are kind of bright and vibrant. So what you had to do if you were really interested in getting there was to dye a piece of cloth first with blue and then with yellow. However, this to the medieval mind was intensely suspicious. The idea of purity was taken very seriously. And so green, because it was seen as an admixture of blue and yellow, had the idea of falsity and mixture and being almost against nature, completely the opposite, in other words, to the way we think of it now. Well, greens have actually become a lot more popular of late. So while they were slightly reviled in the Middle Ages, particularly in the West, now they're seen as something to be celebrated. And this goes back to the 1970s, when avocado green really was one of the most fashionable colours of the decade.
If you are curious to hear what Cassia has to say about avocado green, the rest of that story is at our website, marketplace.org. This final note today, it appears that I am not alone in my constant streaming of All I Want for Christmas Is You over the past few weeks.
Thank you, Mariah. The New York Times reports that just about everybody is streaming holiday music and not much else. Last year, holiday music hit 2.4 billion streams in the fourth quarter. That's up from 1.3 billion the year before. We'll see how this year clocks in. Record labels are reportedly telling their artists, look, this is not the time for new material. You can release it once we've all stopped streaming A Charlie Brown Christmas. Today, the Dow was down 28 points, a tenth of a percent. The NASDAQ shed 5 points, essentially flat. S&P 500 lost a point, pretty much unchanged. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Adrian Hill will be filling in all next week. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.